Where are we?
We're in my office.
Hey, look at me. Okay. Same thing that we always do with channel 9 interviewers. Okay. Look at me. Forget the cameras here.
Okay.
Who are you? That's my famous question starting out. Who are you?
I'm a geek. I'm Jim Olchin.
And what do you do?
What do I do? I run what's called the Platforms Group. That's the organization that ships most of the heavy API carriers for the company. SQLs and Exchanges and Windows. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Windows?
Yep.
Hold on a second. Let me just close the door.
Okay. See, that happened last time where you're wandering around and I'm following you. And then they say, what was he doing looking all over?
I know. And then they started criticizing my camera moves. Here, let's just get some wild camera moves. Steve Gilmore. I love him. Wow, so, we're talking about Windows.
You run
the Windows team, right?
Well,
if you wanted to change the start button into a purple color, you probably could get it done, couldn't you?
I probably could get it done.
Wow.
Wow. Think about the power of that. Purple, it could be purple.
What's your average day like? I mean,
average day is, I come in about... I'm here about 7:30,
yeah,
and I leave about give or take 7:30, depending on, assuming I'm here in town. I try not to travel. I really, really, really try hard not to travel. It's why, people never see me out because there's so much more to do here. There are actually three senior vice presidents that run the businesses in my organization,
right?
And they're really responsible for running the business, and for the last few years. In fact, since I've been at Microsoft, I've been trying to get more and more where I spend more of my time on the technology and not trying to run the business. I still get called in for some very difficult business problems or perhaps legal-related things, but I try to spend my time on the technology. And when I get here, I try to have a set of time that I can do a little bit of email before a set of meetings happen. And then I spend, unfortunately, most of my time in meetings, doing reviews, and then sometimes in between those, quickly whipping out some email. And then I also have some days that I set up for doing what I call demos or think days, where I spend time in a lab, which is... my choice was to have a bigger office or more lab, and I chose more lab. And so I have a lot of equipment in there that I have packed days where I run through lots of time where I can do hands-on in there.
Right. What's a review like? You know, I've heard from other people, oh, I got to do a Jim Hall review today. What, from your point of view, what is like that like? Because I've heard it from the other point of view.
I think there's, I think about reviews in two ways.
Yeah.
One is that it's a brainstorm, and the other is a review.
Right.
And I like to make it clear which one it is. If it's a brainstorm, all views are open and we can brainstorm about a lot of stuff. I don't consider myself in a reviewer position. I may even change where I sit in the room. And it's a more open, free flow of ideas. And I love those. A review is when there is an area that I'm either going to be updated on. There's two types of reviews even, sub points of a review on education. They're just trying to educate me on something that, you know, is not an area that I'm very focused on. And the second area is a set of topics that I'm trying to track or that I think are messed up.
Right.
And I'm trying to see how we're doing. And those, I think about those almost like a PhD defense, at least when I went through that. It's, you're coming to review. I am going to challenge to see that there's understanding of all the things I could think about and that people agree in the room. Because it's important that if something is spanning lots of different technologies to do some particular feature, that the networking team and the core architecture team and the security team and everybody all agrees in there. And I'll be probing to see how that works out. And I'll see if they really understand their performance ramifications of what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
before I came to Microsoft, I've read books about you. I've seen interviews with you. You know, you run the Windows team, which is one of the biggest products in the world. What don't we know about you? What would you like to tell us about you that we might not yet know?
Well, I think there's probably a mystique about anybody that gets written about in the press, and most of it's probably totally untrue. I'm very passionate. That part should be clear, and I am trying to drive toward quality and doing the right thing. From a technology perspective, I've been very frustrated on where Microsoft has been in the past. In fact, it took a year for me to actually agree to come here because I didn't think the quality was appropriate, and I didn't think much of DOS, and I didn't think much of Windows, and OS 2 was a complete blowout. And so it took me a long time to say, was Bill really, really interested in doing something like NT and doing something like networking that wasn't like LAN manager to the sign, but much more integrated? So I guess first I would say dispelling, you know, whatever the aura is or mystique, because I'm truly just a geek, and I do love to play with technology, and I like to build things. Most people know I also play music, and I did that professionally for a while. I still play a lot, but not professionally. I starved, and you know, having Cheerios without milk, you know, for most of the month, because I'd be in food stamps at the beginning of the month, and then I would go on. The food stamps would run out, and then I'm basically pretty substantive.
I have a feeling software development is a little bit more lucrative.
It was definitely more lucrative. But I'd always love to do it. I just said, okay, I can't make enough money on the music side. Yeah. But I still play. But it's usually at 10 o'clock at night after the kids are in bed, and I can go down and play a little bit.
Right.
I record everything on Windows.
Excellent. Longhorn is sort of peeking around your shoulder there. We're still not willing to show it on video, but...
Oh, no!
Oh, you can see the screen. That's it. That's all you get to see right now.
This one's running build 5059. This one's an older build, 5054. This is my test machine.
Yeah.
I'm able to do some really abusive things in this machine. This is my main machine, and
so you're dog fooding Longhorn. You're running.
I've been on Longhorn for about 3 months now.
Okay,
and it was painful when I first went over to it because the build-to-build upgrades didn't work. It was a fresh install every time. That was pretty painful. Now the build-to-build upgrades are working, so it's not as painful. So it's I like to be on stuff early. Very early, so I can track it. I have stuff in the lab, but it's nothing like using it.
Yeah.
I just came back from a trip, even though I don't like to travel, because I'd rather spend my time here. I just came back from the trip, and I was using a laptop with Longhorn the whole week, and that was also another interesting experience as I tried to see, you know, where we are in the bills.
Tell me about your trip, because you met with bloggers, you met with press people. What did you learn on that trip? What do you do a trip for? Is it just to tell people, hey, Longhorn's coming? Or,
well, there were several things I was trying to do. First, there's a lot of events going to happen throughout this year and beginning of next, and I felt like someone needed to go put context around it, not only about Longhorn, but about the 64-bit work that we're doing, what's happening in UConn, the SQL Server, and what's happening in Whidbey, and just sort of put context around everything. I wanted people to understand, you know, that what we're going to do at WinHack, that we've got the driver model locked for Longhorn, but the rest of the bits, you know, are far from locked, and most of the features are going to come later.
Yeah.
I wanted to put context around what we're trying to accomplish in Beta 1, what we're trying to accomplish at the PDC this year, et cetera, et cetera. I also wanted to know why I thought 64-bit was so important, and I do think it's a really big deal, but not one that's going to change the revenues of any particular company, but it's just an industry transition that we're going to go through that I think is preordained and will give all of us a lot more address space
yeah.
to play with. And then also I want to talk about this thing I call the excitement on the edge of the network, because we spend so much time talking about the internet. And I think about the internet as this sort of water that we're all floating in, but when I think about it is, although there's sites out there that are very exciting and there's great innovation going on, there's amazing innovation going on the edge of the network. And this edge of the network thing has me fascinated, because I don't think people have been talking about it or even seeing it yet. If you mention all the things I see happen, they start nodding their heads. It's like, you know,
give me some idea.
64-bit processing, okay. Is on the PCs, or take the phones. These phones, the power that's going to be in the processors in the phone is amazing. Take capacity of storage from, you know, incredible capacity but very small size, or GPUs. What you can do in a GPU today is unbelievable, and it's going to get faster over time. Or take connectivity. There's a new wireless standard, you know, every week doing something and tying together the you know, either quality of service or whatever. There's just incredible excitement. And then look at the form factors, from media center extenders to flash-based music devices to the Sony-based PlayStation for video, yeah, as well as games. Or our portable media center for watching movies, or disc-based players for music, or the phones with discs, and on and on and on and on and on, the tablets and this and that. It's amazing. Then you think about what's happening peer-to-peer. And I'm a peer-to-peer huge fan. And I don't mean, you know, just swapping music. I mean what's happening with Skype, what's happening with Groove, what's happening with, you know, folder sharing, what's happening with all the games that are peer-to-peer, Bridge and Poker and whatever. That's an incredible platform. And what's happening is, although you can go to the internet for a destination, as a significant amount of what's happening is just using it as a pipe. Yeah. And I see that happening more and more. And if I have a set of machines, say laptops, coming into a meeting, I don't want to talk to the internet to form a nice collaborative meeting. Or if I'm in the airport or on the plane, I just want to talk with the people on the plane. I want it to just form naturally. Or if I'm actually out in the broader space, I want to be able to use the internet, but mainly as a pipe. I don't want anybody to eavesdrop on me. I don't want them to understand, see what I'm doing. But I want to be able to form these collaborative environments.
Yep.
And with all the power that's there and all the processing and storage, it just makes it natural if we can solve some of the distributed computing. And if you do know anything about my background, all my work in the past has all been in networking and distributed computing. So that's where my real technical love is, along with operating systems. So then we also have the thing, we're going from hyperlinking to search, whereas that's where everybody's brain is today, I think, to moving over to what I call subscriptions. And RSS is obviously the rage right now, but if you can subscribe to all sorts of things, including the typical news, but also photos from your family and everything else, you can get it to your client. I don't want the internet to be too super involved in that once I get it to the client. I want to be able to manipulate it, view it, and use all that power and storage there. So anyway, I can go on and on and on, but the point is, tremendous stuff happening around the edge. And it's not saying that that web servers aren't going to continue to do great things, but even if you look at the companies that are really into service, they're spending a lot of time trying to get differentiation on the client side.
Right.
And one of the great things about web services, you if you do a good job, you won't know who you're talking to. It can just be a service, so you can do great programmatic things with it. So if we can get the internet to be more programmatic, and we have these rich devices, it's just amazing what you can end up doing. But I think there's a lot of differentiation that those web service companies are going to try to do on the smart clients, so that they can, you know, get some competitive advantage there. And you can see that with what Google's doing with Hello or whatever. Who knows what they're going to do with it? But I mean, that's a peer-to-peer app and proves it.
It's a couple days after WinHack, right? So we just went through WinHack, and I see the reaction. The neat thing about the internet now is you can see the global reaction to one of our product announcements and see it in live time and see, yep, you know, thousands of people writing, yep, about it. And yep, overall, everybody's like, where's the thing that's going to thrill me? I haven't seen it yet. So give me some context about what we just saw at WinHack and what's going to be thrilling about Longhorn?
Thrill me, chill me. Well, we weren't trying to thrill you at WinHack. We really weren't. There were two things we were trying to do at WinHack with what we showed with Longhorn. First is to motivate some of the reasons why we needed drivers or protocols done. So an example would be we showed off some of the graphics to motivate why LDDM drivers are needed.
Yeah. And what is LDD?
The Longhorn display driver model.
Okay.
Or another example was we showed off Metro, and we showed off Metro to motivate why there would be advantages of supporting that in devices such as printers or, you know, scanners or something.
What is Metro?
Metro is what we talk about as a fixed form representation of an Avalon print renderer that'll be standard and that will move the current format that we're using for output to the printers into to have both the old form as well as this fixed form. Anyway, so we were trying to motivate several things. That's why we're doing certain demos and not others.
Amen.
The other thing we're doing was we were trying to set the record straight about what type of capability would be in the system in terms of end-user capabilities, because there was a lot of people besides just device writers in the audience, where we're going beyond search into this visualize and organize and capability. And so we showed some of the power that would be there in terms of how you could slice and dice data and find things and visualize things using basically metadata within the system. And many people had the misconception when we decided to take WinFS, let me be clear, I decided to take WinFS and say that it needed longer and it couldn't make this cycle for the OS and take longer with that, that they thought that it was going to, we weren't going to have any capabilities at all in terms of organization or visualization or search.
Right.
And
I
was trying to make the point of, well, I don't really want to spend a lot of time and make this a coming out party for Longhorn since it wasn't. But I did want to sort of set that context because I heard, oh, well, there's nothing in Longhorn.
Yep.
And so I wanted to at least set the context on that one. This was about getting everybody on board with the driver models and, you know, WS Discovery and some of the other capabilities that we need to get set up for Longhorn. And there'll be, you know, thrilling stuff a little bit later.
Okay.
yeah, we'll see whether we do that, but our intent was not to have that to be the coming out party. This was
right.
The coming out party for X64.
Yeah.
And
there's going to be 64-bit version of Longhorn as well, right?
That's right.
So
that's right.
Why are you so passionate about 64-bit? You mentioned it a couple times already.
Well, I guess there's a whole bunch of reasons. One is just looking at the industry over the years, and you think about, okay, we had 4-bit, 8-bit, and 16-bit, 32-bit. The change from 16 to 32 is difficult because by then we'd gotten into needing memory and we'd gotten segmented, and we had to move from segmented addressing into the flat address space to 386. That was fairly a painful change. It might have been not painful for everybody, but certainly for some apps it was pretty painful. This change is much simpler. So that's the first thing. It's a simpler change, the conversion. Second, I think we've learned how to do WoW, or the Windows on Windows subsystems, and it took us years to be able to get it really as good as we got it from running 16-bit apps on the current, like XP or Windows servers. But now we've got WoW of 32 on 64. We've gotten that really quite good. So the compatibility is much higher. So it's a more easier transition. We've got that there's no price disincentive to make this transition, either on the chips or from companies. At least I'll talk for us. There's no price disincentive from us, same price. You've got the fact that I think there's features in it that are just good for the industry. The fact that there's no execute or what we call, you know, data execute protection, the fact that you can mark pages in memory as no execute, in particular, you can mark the stack that way. Certainly not a panacea for all security issues, but it gives us a little bit more confidence that at least that particular attack, they'll have to use the heap and, you know, or mm-hmm. other techniques in order to take advantage of that. But that's turned on by default. Also in the kernel, we've been able to use some instructions in very unique ways, such that actual changing the instructions of the operating system are quite hard. In other today, if you have certain types of rootkits that might be an attack vector, they could drop in as a device driver. Once they're a device driver, then go over to the page table and change the turn off, no execute, to go change their R code and flip it back on and keep going. Well, we made that pretty hard in X64, and that's a good security measure. Also, just the fact that the registers and the calling conventions that we're using, so much is more passed in registers, which it says if you've got a heavy call depth, then you can get better performance. And there's more. I mean, I can go on. The fact, yeah. if you think out a few years, ignoring video for just a moment, for most knowledge workers and people in offices, if you look at what's underneath their My Documents, it's not that much, memory. In storage.
Yeah. Yep.
So if you think, okay, primary memory is 1,000 times faster, well, okay, this particular version that we just released supports 128 gigabytes of physical memory and 16 terabytes of virtual. But just think about the physical. Let's suppose you put 10 gigs, I don't know, 20 gigs. Let's just go out a few years. All right, 30 or 40 gigs. You can put everything in memory. Just imagine what search, if you're putting all your email, all your documents, all your spreadsheets, everything in memory. That's pretty exciting. Not that you would necessarily do it as brute force, is what I'm suggesting, but yeah. I think it gives us new opportunities that people haven't really thought of.
And make things faster.
Make things faster, and you could do things that today you spend a lot more time thinking about algorithms for, you know, avoiding head seeks and the like.
When did you first get in this industry?
Well, let's see. All my degrees are in computer science. It's like I was one of the first guys in this. But I actually started working in 1973.
Wow.
And I, in high school...
Did you ever envision that the computing industry would come so far in just your lifetime? I mean, just in my lifetime, I've seen it go from, you know, 200K, or my first Apple II was 16K, right?
Right.
Of RAM, and now we're talking about gigabytes of RAM.
Right. 64K was beyond comprehension when I was doing my first multi-threaded operating system. It was like, wow, 64K is just like beyond comprehension. So I have to say, yeah, I have envisioned it, and I think the thing that as I sit here today, we're just scratching the surface. You know, I'm getting up there in age. I still have a lot of passion, but I mean, long after me, this incredible inventions are going to take place. I mean, it's just amazing because the processing power will be there, the storage will be there, and we'll be able to use brute force techniques even if we don't come up with other approaches. It's sort of like chess, that just through brute force you make a long ways. And we, if you have enough of high speed access, you're going to be able to do, you know, better understanding in the sense of understanding speech and the like that we, you know,
yep.
haven't been able to do to date. So I'm when you think about everything being connected all the time, and you think about the massive processing power that's possible, and I think the industry with the multi-core will be pushed to figuring out how to do parallelization, which, you know, we've just because of my age, I've seen this movie once, because this was scientific computing, you know, in the 70s, and, you know, we did, that movie didn't turn out so well.
Yeah.
So we have an opportunity now to go mainstream, because multi-core will drive us to have new tools, which, you know, if you look across, it's hard to write parallelization. People have now figured out threading, even though there's lots of still deadlocks that people put in their code, or live locks or whatever. But we're at a position where I think the industry will be driven to finally address parallelization, and then that's going to give us a whole new set of opportunities for that we haven't had.
So the PC is not dead.
No, the PC is definitely not dead. In fact, the PC equals, I say, personal computing. That involves a lot of different devices. And I think about there's going to be software in all of those, and they're all going to need to talk to each other.
Right.
And I love the fact of autonomous machines getting together, you know, working together to accomplish some task.
Yeah. Let me get the Channel 9 guys involved here, because they sent me a bunch of questions. So let's see. Eagle asked about your involvement with computers. I think we just covered that. Tell me about the tablet. I think Paul Mooney, I think, asked what will be the tablet opportunity. What's coming in tablet PC?
What's coming? Well, I should say that the tablet hasn't made it to the mainstream yet. Media Center's on its way. I think we've crossed the hurdle. It's gonna be a success in a big way. Tablet hasn't, but I am so much of a believer in the tablet. I think the things that have sort of prevented it from really taking off has been, well, our software needed to be improved, but the current software is pretty good. But I think the price point has been something that has kept people from being able to really experience it. And anybody that's really seen any of the note-taking capability that you can do on that, it's such a beautiful device for doing that. I think that we showed off some new form factors at WinHack, but there's some even beyond those that we're working. Very shortly, the price will drop on those devices. And if we can get more people to actually experience them, because they've come such a long ways already, and once we get the price point down a little bit, a lot more people will be able to experience. I mean, it's the natural thing to take to a school setting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so natural. And we've got to make it more available to everybody so they can touch it. And now we've got it so that, you know, if you're left-hand writer, we've improved so much of that. And come Longhorn, the heuristics that we've got, the intelligence of learning about your style and continually improving, it's going to get so much better. So I'm hopeful that we will eventually take it to where it's mainstream. But I'm very.
Do you have any guesses on how long it'll take? 5 years, 10 years before, you know, let's say 80% of all mobile, what we think of mobile computers, will have the ability to ink on them?
Yeah, well, I want to make the point that it's not just inking, because I actually think touch is also very important, and that's something that we've been missing to date, because our digitizers are the type that are electromagnetic and not, that you could do with just touch. We're going to have to add that, because that'll create a new way so you can reach out and touch the machine, and I think that'll directly, that'll give a whole new applicability as well. Do I have I think typing is still a great thing. So I don't envision how many people are going to be writing code with the ink. Will they be doing that in 5 years? Wow, I don't know.
That's a hard challenge. I talked to Bert Keeley about that, and he doesn't see it coming for coders, because the way the handwriting recognition works, it looks at a dictionary, and
that's
code
right.
is not something that can be easily dictionary. It's not German or Japanese language or English or words that can be looked up.
Yeah. He probably told you that, you know, we're getting better because we can look over corpuses on your machine, such as we can read all your email. And we can learn what you're typically talking about. And we'll just continue to improve by learning what you're talking about. And so we can disambiguate so much faster that way.
Okay. Andre DeCosta asks, you said Longhorn is a fundamental platform for building the next generation of Windows apps. Can you expand a little bit more on what makes Longhorn the platform of choice for developers, businesses, and consumers? And let's go to developers. Is there a developer story for Longhorn?
Well, yes.
What is it? So I'm still trying to figure that one out.
Okay. Well, come to the PDC.
Okay.
And you know what Indigo is. You
yes.
know what Avalon is.
Yep.
Okay. Those are core into what we're doing in Longhorn. There's a set of improvements in Win32 that we're doing, Win32, Win64 that we're doing as well. Whole new set of controls. Or the fact of when, if you probably didn't, did you see the WinHack demonstration of the Explorer window that was up there?
During Gates' keynote?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched the video.
So that same window, think about that as the file save dialog that you could use. And when you think, okay, I've got this whole visualization and capability just in the dialog, so I can search and find stuff there that every app can use. So there's a bunch of basic improvements for Win32 that we're delivering. And there's a set of stuff with peer-to-peer that we're trying to improve. There'll be some capabilities for RSS, for being able to use it for control so that you won't have to, if you don't want to, you know, continue to create yet another parser and that sort of work. So there's a set of stuff that people already know about, and that's the part. I think they're waiting for something even more, and it's really what you already know about, plus a whole set of new controls that will be available so that you can, if you have a Win32-bit app, you'll be able to extend it and to fit into it. And then if you have, if you're writing a new app, then you can take advantage of all the managed interfaces that we've got. So we're taking a two-pronged approach to this.
Right. Why would a business like, General Motors or Procter & Gamble, why would they upgrade to Longhorn? What's a business going to get out of upgrading their machines to Longhorn?
Well, let me back up a little bit and say one thing, that in the past, each release for some time has been targeted at one audience. If I think about Windows 2000 when we did it, one thing we were trying to do is fix the servers to get Active Directory in that, and we were trying to say for the client, this is the system for you for business. I wanted to do it for consumers, but we didn't make it. XP, there really wasn't much for business there on the client side other than mobility. I'm being broad, sweeping statements here. But for the consumers, the drive was, let's get rid of this Windows 9X and be able to offer the advantage of a more resilient system without the downsides of what Windows 2000 had. It just wasn't easy enough to use. But the Windows XP, I mean, how much of a developer story did that really have? It really didn't.
Right.
I mean, it carried on a little bit, but it really wasn't. Longhorn's different. We're trying to hit all the bases now. We're trying to do something for business, something for the developers, something for consumers, and frankly, even something for our partners and the OEMs so they can build their systems faster and the like. So if I go back to what's in it for the business, I think the eye is going to be in the eyes of the beholder, but my view of this thing is, let me look at it at two levels. First, the knowledge worker. What does the knowledge worker get? And then I'll say, what does the IT pro who's trying to install this thing get? If you're looking at the knowledge worker side, I think the visualization and organization, that's going to be very helpful to them, be able to search and find their information very easily. There's a set of capabilities of offline and mobility that are very strong. We have something called, marketing had a term called IntelliMirror that we used. Technically, internally, we talk about client-side caching that we put in XP. This really takes it to the next level. So you keep all your stuff offline, and it'll just synchronize in the background in a differential way, very efficient. You know, so even some stuff on that'll be very nice. Mobility, we talked about having things like the auxiliary display and the better wireless, being able to move from work to home. Today,
to Starbucks,
to
the library.
It's quite hard to take a laptop today that's in a domain, take it home, and try to find a printer. Magic that in order to do that. So addressing those that's, in my opinion, for the knowledge worker. And then there's some things that I'm not going to talk about that we hope will be, pizzazzy, that will get them excited. And then from the IT pro side, one of our big things that we feel like we have to do a better job is reducing operational cost. And so we created a whole new setup infrastructure to deal with the imaging problem that customers have. Today, what people do in businesses, they don't just migrate a machine. What they do is they build up a machine exactly the way they want it, with all the software they want on it, apps and everything else. And they have to do it per language, basically, and they do it per hardware configuration. And then they freeze dry it and put it on a server. And they have to do this over and over and over for all their hardware configurations, all their, languages and hardware configurations and their software loads. They put it all out in the servers. By the time they get it all out there, all these images, and each one they have to build, put on the machine, and then they freeze dry it. About that time, Microsoft makes a change, or they make a change, and they have to start all over again. Okay, so we're not going to do it that way in Longhorn. We're going to make it much more where you can service offline. You won't have to worry about the locale issue for the languages, and the hardware configuration is auto-sent, so you won't have to have as many images. So we should think just the imaging stuff will reduce the cost. There's new management capabilities in it, so they'll be able to forward events up to the management consoles in a better way. And another example would be, today, sadly, most people run their systems in admin. If you're running as admin, you get something bad, and you can basically not only take down yourself and some other user, you can take down the OS. So we're adding something that we're talking about, a standard user. So you're running sort of, it's embarrassing that we haven't had
done this
before.
Yet. Okay. Thanks for remaking that. Cause
my eyes down. Big shame. But anyway, so you're running as a...
to me, this is the most exciting thing about Longhorn, even though it's the least thrilling.
You're running a standard user. So yeah. Now you won't be able to impact another user or the OS. So to me, just those levels of control... capabilities will be something that the IT pros will say, hey, this will save me money.
That sort of sounds like we're building virtual PC into Longhorn. Is that how you're doing that? Or
no, in this particular case, we're not.
Okay.
The technique that we're using to do this, I almost pulled it off in SP2, but we didn't quite pull it off. We put in an integrity system that's actually using the security aspects are already in the system to where when you run a process, it's almost in a secure mode, and it does not have writes. It runs in limited writes into the rest of the system. And we didn't pull it off in SP2 because we just didn't have enough time to bake and think this through. We are adding some techniques both for Lua, especially for Lua, or this is the standard user.
Yeah.
For virtualizing the registry and virtualizing the file system so we can get more apps to run even if they're doing things that they shouldn't be. In other words, accessing some admin areas of the registry or whatever so that we can virtualize that. But even then, we're not using the virtual PC. Virtual PC is a very alluring technique to do this in a brute force way, but it comes with some downsides.
Performance.
Well, even beyond performance, do you want multiple start menus? Do you really have the security nailed when you share stuff between the things? Do you really want to load programs into both? And there's a whole bunch of stuff. We've done a lot of experimentation on that. I think what we're doing on standard user and the low writes work, I think, is more effective. You don't have multiple operating systems to update. It's just one operating system that's more a secure process type of model. That's not to say... We might do something with virtual PC, though, for more brute force things. But what I'm talking about here is not using that technology.
What kind of applications are going to be upgraded for Longhorn?
I want
to make sure I understand. Are you talking about how does Office look on it, or do you mean the little applets and stuff?
He was talking about Paint, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It includes, like, Paint and Notepad. Yeah, yeah. You know, what kind of innovations are going to be made in Outlook Express and...
Right. Yeah. It's a little bit early for me to say,
okay.
But we are trying to refresh them and add some others. So, it's still too early for me to say. But we are, it's not like they're going to languish. We actually have a team away whose job it is to refresh those, as well as add some others. Yeah. They weren't really refreshed in XP, and, you know, it's time. So we will be doing that.
Right. You mentioned before Avalon and Indigo. Are those actually going to be in Longhorn?
Yes.
Okay, because there was some confusion on that standpoint, too.
Well, there's the reason why I think there may be confusion is it's how much of the system is going to depend on which pieces. And that's a very complicated question with a complicated answer. There's parts of Avalon that we're using to do the desktop compositor because we added a desktop compositor.
What? Now, explain what that is. Because
okay.
I'm still understanding and learning, so I know that people watching are like, what's that?
Have you ever been on a machine and all of a sudden one of the Windows apps gets not responding. And you drag that around your screen, and your screen just gets all white, you know, wherever you drag, or black, or whatever, and you can mess up the whole screen by just dragging this one window around. That's an example of not having the desktop compositor, because there's not one central point that's going through to that's controlling everything that's painted on the screen. We're changing that, so there is one desktop compositor that everything goes through, and that'll give us tremendous capability to do the transition effects between windows, a set of things which we haven't shown yet that, you know, will have some pizzazz. It gives us the ability to avoid that sort of grossness that's happening of not having that central place. It also gives us the ability to add tremendous power of live thumbnails everywhere, and so that's something that we're working on. So it is both a solve, in my opinion, a design issue that I've felt like we needed to do. It's difficult because you have to have pretty good performance in order to drive it through there, because you're actually, if you need to be in lockstep with the hardware in order to do this really effectively. Anyway, so that part is all Avalon as well. Then we have Avalon, the set of class libraries that are used. So there's parts of the system that are intimately using Avalon, and there's parts that, you know, are more apps are going to end up using it. So yes, Avalon and Indigo are both in the system.
Very cool. I'm just looking at the Longhorn intranet page, and I see a bunch of RSS all over the place. Can you tell me about what Longhorn is going to do with RSS? Really simple syndication.
Yes.
You know what it is. I'm just
okay. Right. Right.
My mom doesn't know what RSS is yet. So.
Does she watch Channel 9?
Yeah, no. Maybe.
So, I don't think that we're far enough along for me to, so let me phrase it like this. Everything I'm about to say is subject to change, because we're not far enough along where I'm willing to say I know exactly. But generally, we want to put a set of controls in that just make it simple to use RSS in the system. We want to make it easy, certainly in the browser, in order to subscribe to it. And we also want to make it easy in order to do basic reading of it. We may go beyond this, but that's the gist of what I feel. You know, there's work going on all those pieces right now, and we may go beyond that. It's such a cool thing, and my dream is to create enough of a platform so that people can then innovate on top of it and just take some of the grunt work out of doing some of the base pieces.
Right. The first thing on this page is search. Yeah. Search like never before, it says. Tell me what's cool about the search. What's different about searching on Longhorn than searching on XP, even if you have like the MSN desktop toolbar system?
Well, so, one of the things that people don't understand is the history of indexing. You know, indexing goes way back into the early 90s when we first started on this. It's always been a dream for us to put in the system. We put it in Windows 2000. I don't know if people remember that. And we put it in XP, improved in XP. And I tried to turn it on by default, but that didn't work out because it didn't work very well. And it's still in the system. You can turn it on. And when it says, do you want to index your system fast, you can just hit this button. And you can start, I think it's when the dog.
Clip here or whatever.
Yeah, it was there. But you can turn on fast indexing. And that technology, that same team has continued to work on it. So that's the indexer technology that we're putting in Longhorn, just much improved. And then that same code base was what, a snap of that earlier stuff is what the MSN team is doing today. But why is it better? Well, I think it's a lot to do with how we're using the indexing, because we're going to use it in terms of doing the viewing in the organization. And I think that's different. The other comment is that because we can do it holistically and consistently through the UI, you'll be able to search for your programs or your games or in the control panel or in your help system or for your documents, etc., all in the same consistent way. And that, to me, that consistency is a great, great thing that we're trying to permeate everywhere. And my hope is that we just do a good job on what I consider the plumbing basics of this stuff. Most of these systems today are really, technically, I don't think work that well, because they you know, when do they run? Do they, you know, do you ever have to rebuild the index? Does it take away your performance? Is there ever a hiccup on you? How many processes are really running when you're doing this, et cetera, et cetera. So some of this is just really making this a very strong native part of the system that you get those benefits. And I see I'm really being dinged to leave.
Okay. Thanks for spending a lot of time with us.
Thanks.
Anything else to close out?
That no, we should no, know thank, about? Thanks to...
When are we going to? When are people going to be able to play with Longhorn? Beta 1 is coming this summer.
Early summer, yeah.
Okay.
They can play with it then. It's not going to be the, you know, some major rollout. One of the things I hope to change, I'll say this and, you know, help this to help commit the team to it, is I'd like to do much more incremental releases. I love the preview stuff. So I want to come out with, you know, every month or so when we've got a drop, just give it out to people. People have to understand that, you know, some stuff may work, some stuff may not. Yeah. Some, you know, we may go back and forth. Some stuff we may drop because we can't make it work really as well as we want. But I want to be much more transparent, and I think those days of the massive betas, and that's the only time you hear from us, I think those are a bygone era. Right. I still think we'll do those big things because we have to lock on something stable enough for corporates to really consider deploying. But the big deal for us will be toward beta 2. But people can play with it at beta 1. They just need to understand it's only a part of the system that's going to be there.
So beta 2 is what we call feature complete? Is that where? Okay.
Yeah.
And that's coming like next year?
Well, we haven't set a date for it. I'm going to see how the PDC goes, beta 1, and we'll set a date. We do have dates for these other ones. Beta 2 will vary. And now cool. I'm really getting...
Thank you very much, and
thank
see you at the PDC.
Okay.
Thanks.